So there weren't many questions today. And I debated about just having a silent sitting. But then I thought of a question that also arose in one of the groups. Thought I'd wander around that one too. So we have a few questions. And the first one's a question about dedicating the merit. This is a practice that is a kind of an expression, in a way, of both the appreciation for our practice and for the understanding that as we practice, it has this, I used the word contagious effect the other day. It ripples out from us. The people that we meet are affected by the goodness, essentially. I think of sharing the merit. And the sharing of the merit is basically a intentional aspiration that the goodness that is cultivated in our practice be offered not only to support our own awakening, our own understanding, but that it be also of support to others. So it's a beautiful aspiration, a beautiful wish. It feels in the realm of metta to me. That wish to share the goodness, to share the benefits, the conscious expression that may this practice be of support to the world. And I think in a very, because of this kind of contagious nature of the practice, you know, that are the goodness that we cultivate, even if it's simple awareness that you're present when you're talking to somebody you don't know, where there's a connection and a care and awareness, not just getting on with your day, but just being there. When you check out at the grocery store, not talking about a deep, soulful gaze, but, you know, just kindness. Maybe not just kindness. I mean, that's not a just. Kindness is a powerful, profound thing. And when we are that way, we don't know the effects that that simple action has, that kindness. Maybe that will shift that person's day a little bit, change how they relate to somebody later, and maybe that will change how that person relates to somebody later. And so in a very real way, our practice does affect each other, which is really a lovely thing to contemplate. And that's essentially what the sharing of the merit is doing, is it's encouraging us to contemplate this contagion of goodness. So it's a beautiful practice. It's a kind of a conscious the sharing of merit is a kind of a conscious bringing in of that intention. It's often done at particular times. It's done often at the ending of things. The ending of a retreat is often in this context where the merit is consciously shared. Sometimes at the ending of groups, it would be done, it could be done. In my own experience, my own like being on retreat with so many people, so many different teachers at different times, primarily the main place that I've experienced it done is at the ending of the retreats. So the question was, why don't we dedicate the merit at the end of our group meetings? That would be a lovely thing to do. It's just not something that I've had modeled for me in any of my practice discussions with other teachers. And just to point to, you know, the sharing of merit is something we can also do internally. If it's meaningful for you, it's a kind of an expression of that aspiration that it can motivate our practice to wish that our goodness be of support to others. It reminds us that we're not just practicing for ourselves, but that we're practicing for others too. And for some, that's very supportive. And so you're welcome to share the merit anytime you wish. Question about comparing mind. In my case, I think that comparing mind gets in the way of compassion. How can I release this? Comparing mind is already, it's a kind of a separation. There's a me and a other, self and other, in comparing. And so with that separation, often judgment about them, judgment about us. And that very separation, this question makes a lot of sense to me, because that very separation, the division that's generated there, kind of an inherent, in a way, block to compassion, which flourishes where there are no divisions. And so this seems like a skillful recognition that this pattern of comparing, which, by the way, you are not alone in having this happen, that this pattern does kind of get in the way, of a heart that feels connected. You know, the separation of me, you're like this, I'm like this. You're better, I'm worse. I'm better, you're worse. All this comparing. You know, that separation, whereas compassion is about connection. And so seeing this can be It's, I think, just seeing it and naming it is really the first step, the first piece of the answer to the question, how can this be released? That's how I would frame the question, rather than how can I release this? How might this be released? How might this shift? How might this change? So with a recognition like this, I mean, it can feel painful, right? It can feel painful to see that a habit of mind, and that's what comparing is, deep habit of mind that we tend to divide ourselves into me and you and make these comparisons. It's a pretty human thing to do. And painful to see that this thing that's just happening, when we start to see these habits and patterns, and this, like many habits and patterns, when we see them, the deeply conditioned ones, we do start to see that, you know, I'm not actually consciously doing this. And when I can see how painful it is, how hard it is on the system, this experience, and how much it creates the separation, how much it blocks that sense of connection and care. There might be the question, why would I do this? Why would I do this? It's partly, I think, for all many of our reactive emotions, the beliefs and delusions embedded in those emotions thinks, those beliefs think they are doing something for us. They think they're helping us. They are so confused. And so, you know, one thing to recognize about these patterns, and we've been talking about this, it's not you picking it up and saying, oh, I'm going to compare, I'm going to judge, it's not self that this is happening. It's conditioned. Now that's one really good thing to remember. For myself, as I began to see some of my deep habits and patterns as conditioned, I remember one time around the self-hatred, you know, just really seeing, oh my goodness, I see how this is conditioned. This comes from, you know, all of that stuff that happened. And there was a lot of, just a direct seeing of that pattern as conditioned was so helpful. It created quite a bit of space around it. For a few, hours, it went away. It was like, oh yeah, right, this is conditioned. But pretty much it didn't touch the pattern. You know, it kept coming back with equal strength, even to have seen it was conditioned. And so with a pattern like this, you know, the recognition of it as conditioned can be supportive, can be helpful. And in my own experience, it's helpful because it allows us to be more easeful, there to be more ease with the observing of the pattern. Less of a sense of, it's me that's doing this, I should be able to stop this. When we see it's conditioned, we understand we can't stop it. It's just a conditioned pattern, and it's going to arise when the conditions come together. And so the identification with the pattern can begin to fall away. It doesn't mean that the pattern stops. Patterns have so much momentum. And so perhaps the identification with the pattern falls away a little bit with that understanding. Sometimes just remembering that, you know, kind of bringing in that as a wisdom reminder. Okay, comparing is happening and it's conditioned. That might create a little bit of space, a little bit of space to be able to kind of like be willing to notice the comparing. So the overarching theme here, the overarching direction is, how is this comparing mind released? Largely, it's released by not resisting it and not fighting it, but watching it and feeling it, understanding it. That teaching from that first talk, the understand those defilements, understand those reactive habits and patterns of mind. With that understanding, wisdom releases them. So patience and trust to actually have, and courage, I think a lot of courage to meet these patterns. I think this question can really be stand-in for pretty much any deeply conditioned habit and pattern. These reactive habits and patterns block the wholesome qualities. In this case, blocks the understanding is this blocking compassion. So these reactive habits and patterns block the wholesome qualities. And as the habits and patterns are released through understanding, through wisdom, the teaching is, in this case, non-comparing. And comparing is connected to delusion. So non-delusion is understood to be a ground for the wholesome, a root of the wholesome. So the very releasing of the reactivity through wisdom is what creates the conditions, the support for the wholesome to flourish. In that sutta, the simile of the cloth, the direction of the practice was pointed to when these reactive habits and patterns are understood and they are abandoned, then confidence arises. So it's not immediate necessarily that, suddenly you'll be in this like abiding in infinite compassion, but confidence arises. And with that confidence, there's some other wholesome qualities that can begin to grow. The next set of qualities in the sutta are delight, joy, tranquility, happiness, and concentration. Sometimes called the gladness pentad, if you like language like that. Five qualities that kind of naturally tumble from each other. Delightful, wholesome, beautiful, very heart qualities, most of them. Real heart qualities. Delight, joy, happiness, real heart qualities that naturally arise with the release from these reactive habits and patterns. And then the sutta points to, and one abides in the metta, in the compassion. Again, not something that we do, but the development, the flourishing of that, a natural unfolding. And so really, again, the work here is in the courage to meet the pattern, the courage to feel, oh, this is what it's like to be a human being that's comparing. Feel the pain of that. Feel the separation of that. Feel how that does block connection. That information, and when we're caught in comparing, we're not feeling those things. When we're caught in comparing, we are believing that the comparing is somehow helping me. It's helping me to feel like I'm better than that person, or or, you know, sometimes it can be flipped over. I'm not as good as that person. That person, you know, and somehow our mind actually thinks it's getting something out of that too. It took me, yeah, like, what does my mind think it's getting out of self-hatred? Sometimes those flavors are just the familiar things that we've gotten used to being with, and that's what it gets out of it. It's kind of like, I know this. Miserableness, I know this. This is who I am. This is. And so the mindfulness of it, we're no longer embedded. The mind, the experience is no longer embedded in the delusions and beliefs of that state of mind. The delusions here embedded in comparing. The beliefs of, I need to think of myself as better than or worse than, or I need to think of them as other. That is just seen as, oh, the mind is thinking of them as other. What does that feel like? Feeling the separation, feeling the rattledness, feeling the agitation of that. Wisdom. It's like the mind is getting a different education about how these habits and patterns affect us. Without the mindfulness, we are just following the delusions, essentially. Following the delusions. And it does take courage to meet these habits and patterns. It takes time. It takes patience. And so there are times when there is not the capacity, when there's not the... when we see a pattern or habit, oh, that's comparing. Oh, that's what it's like for a human being to be comparing. Well, yeah, that's what I need to do. And we're just off, you know, in that habit or pattern. And so that may be kind of a signpost that right now the mind is doesn't quite have the capacity to meet that pattern. And so the compassionate thing to do there for yourself, because the being lost in it is going to be suffering for yourself, the compassionate thing to do there is to set it aside, put your attention on something else. And right there, you know, you're cultivating compassion in a different way, cultivating self-compassion. Understanding how a connection with suffering, the mind can take care and turn the attention in another way. It might be that what might be useful, it depends on where you are, it could be useful to actively explore cultivating compassion. In that particular scenario, I would say self-compassion would be the most natural, because what you're experiencing is suffering. You know, it could be challenging to try to turn around and say, okay, what I'm going to do right now, because I see this, you know, this comparing is creating suffering. So what I'm going to do is see if I can have compassion for that other person. And maybe that's not where the heart can go in that moment. So a compassionate action in that moment might or might not have anything to do with the direct cultivation of compassion through compassion practice. But the activity of kind of bowing to that pattern and saying, yep, you're strong, I see you, and not able to be with you right now, so I'm going to put my attention on something else, and not repressing that habit or pattern. So there's a kind of a way in which there's compassion both for our hearts and minds experiencing that, but also a kind of compassion or an honoring or a a respecting that that energy of comparing is just a part of the mind that is confused. And so, kind of like you might skillfully treat a confused being, saying, "Yeah, okay, you know, I see you're confused. And I see you're also not able to like listen right now. So why don't we just like take a walk together and put our, you know, let's just talk about something else right now." So that turning away can be an expression of compassion, which then also will begin to tenderize the heart in that way. So the very activity of being curious about having the courage when it's possible to meet the pattern, the comparing mind in this case, already, I mean, that is simultaneously cultivating the release of that painful pattern through the awareness of it. And at the same time, the activity or the exploration of that is like, well, what is it like to be feeling comparing mind, you know, that allowing quality of mindfulness? That also cultivates compassion. It has compassion in it. And I think this is how that natural unfolding, the natural kind of movement that Sutta describes of, you know, when one has understood the reactive habits and patterns of mind, they are abandoned. You know, that very activity of understanding is already cultivating compassion, already cultivating love and equanimity. It's already cultivating those pramavihars just through how we are attending to the experience. So this kind of mindfulness practice, we think of it as maybe a heady practice or, you know, just wisdom practice, but the very way we attend to experience includes care, includes that compassionate heart. So that also will support the cultivation of compassion. So it's not something we can decide to do. I can't release this. But that whole kind of process of being curious about exploring, just having seen comparing mind gets in the way of compassion, maybe that can create some curiosity and interest in being willing to be with the comparing mind, to understand it and feel the way it also supports, naturally supports the cultivation of the wholesome qualities. So a third question came out of the talk the other day about yathābhūta, seeing things as they are. And the question is connected to the brief exploration around the Bahīya Sutta, that teaching a monk, a practitioner, wasn't one of the Buddha's followers, Bahīya, came to the Buddha and basically said, can you tell me the teachings in brief? And I described, I told part of that teaching, just the first part, the training that the Buddha encouraged Bahia to have. He said, you should train yourself thus. In the seen is only the seen. In the heard is only the heard. In the sensed is only the sensed. In the cognized is only the cognized. And we explored that a little bit in that talk. And the question comes from a part that's of the sutta that's a little bit later. But to respond to that question, I want to wander a little bit around the sutta. And in particular, wander with another translation of, not translation, another instance of the Buddha offering this teaching. There's a second one in the suttas. In the case of Bahia, the Buddha seemed to understand that the way he could, you know, that Bahia was pretty close to really understanding things, because as soon as Bahia heard this teaching, he got enlightened. In the other sutta, the Buddha has a little bit more elaboration around it, and at the end of it, you know, the student basically says, okay, here's what I got from you. Here's what I think you said. And the Buddha said, yep, that's good. And he went off and practiced with it. And it says, and in not a long time he got enlightened. So, but, you know, it wasn't like the instant enlightenment with Bahia. It was more of a practice. He took this instruction, he reflected on it, and worked with it. So there was a preface to the teaching that I find really evocative. So to this student, who his name is Melankyaputta, the Buddha started, he had the same kind of question. He said, will you teach me the teachings in brief? And the Buddha elaborated just a little more than he did to Bahia. The Buddha started with, what do you think, Melankyaputta? The forms cognizable by the eye that are unseen by you, that you have never seen before, that you don't see, that were not to be seen by you. Do you have any craving there? And he says, no. And he went through the other senses, the other four in this case. Sounds cognizable by the ear that are not heard by you, that you have never heard before, that you don't hear, and that are not to be heard by you. Do you have any desire or passion there? This is an interesting kind of, to me, it's like a pointing out instruction. Things that you can't even think about. Things that you've never seen before, that you couldn't even imagine, you know, that it's like, not just things, I mean, that this is not quite like, you know, things that are not seen right now. Like you could still have craving for, like if you've been to Hawaii before, right? You're not seeing Hawaii right now, but there can still be the idea of Hawaii in your mind and craving for that. But I think of this more as like just a pointing to, when you have no idea that something exists, could you possibly have craving for it? You have no idea that this sight happens, this sound could happen, that there be any craving for it. To me, this kind of stops the mind a little bit. And so I feel like he's kind of tenderizing Melankyaputta's mind here. This is a pointing to what it means to not crave around sight, sound, sensing. and cognizing. And so he goes on then to give the same teaching that he gave to Bahia. In reference to then, he said then, in reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. And the heard, only the heard. And the sensed, only the sensed. And the cognized, only the cognized. This is how you should train yourself. And so it's a pointing to, I think of almost like, when there's something seen, it's like if you're seeing it now, but moments before you weren't seeing it, was there any craving before it, before you saw it? Kind of a pointing to that. This craving is springing up now. It's not necessary. And a pointing to the possibility that there might be sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touch, for which there would not be craving, would not be identification, would not be desire or aversion. So I think he was kind of offering Melanchthyputta a way to taste or feel what it might mean in the seen is only the seen, in the heard is only the heard, in the sensed is only the sensed. Just a little flavor of that through that question. Ideas cognizable by the mind that are uncognized, that have never before been cognized, that you don't cognize and that are not to be cognized, do you have any desire or passion there? The absence or the non arising of that, the non-there-ness of that, there's no craving there. So it gives just a flavor of that, the absence of the craving, which then points to what might be possible when there is the sight without craving, what might be possible there. Another way to kind of taste or touch into this, what this means in the seen is only the seen, and the heard is only the heard, and the sensed is only the sensed, and the cognized is only the cognized. This is a pretty cryptic statement. In another sutta, the Buddha gives a description of his own experience around these four, around seen, heard, sensed, cognized. It kind of describes how he experiences the world. He speaks of himself. He doesn't say I. He says a Tathagata. That term means one who is thus gone. And that first part of the word Tata is the word translated sometimes as thus or as such. That word came up the other day in another question. A Tathagata is one who is such, one who sees suchness, something like that. So he refers to himself in this way. A Tathagata does not conceive of a visible thing apart from sight, does not conceive of an unseen, does not conceive of a thing worth seeing, does not conceive of a seer. A Tathagata does not conceive of an audible thing apart from hearing, does not conceive of an unheard, does not conceive of a thing worth hearing, does not conceive of a hearer. Does not conceive of a thing to be sensed apart from sensation, does not conceive of an unsensed, does not conceive of a thing worth sensing, does not conceive of one who senses. The Tathagata does not conceive of a cognizable thing apart from cognition, does not conceive of an uncognized, does not conceive of a thing worth cognizing, does not conceive of a cognizer. So this term for conceiving is really a term for separation. One who conceives is conceiving of themselves as separate from things. Not the entirety of this is exploring or pointing to non-separation. The process of seeing is not separate from the sight. There's not a seer who sees things. So the exploration here, the pointing here is again a pointing to the processes of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, cognizing are processes that run themselves. The seeing sees, hearing hears. No, the not cognizing, not creating an idea about a visible thing separate from the seeing, that this to me points to what is experienced. The only thing that's experienced is the construction of the mind. So when there's a sight, the experience, what is actually experienced, and this is pointing to, you know, in the scene is only the scene, the actual experiences of what has been created in the mind. The sight, meeting of the three is consciousness, contact, feeling, perception, recognition there. All of that happens in the mind. You're not actually experiencing something out there. All that we can know is what's here in the mind. That's it. It's useful to infer, we could say, or I don't know, to recognize that this. I don't think that there's nothing out there. That's what I think it means by does not conceive of an unseen. You know, not to conceive either that there's something out there or that there's nothing out there. Just that what is experienced is a construction of the mind, and that's all that can be known. That's all that can be known. So I think there are things out there. You know, I don't think I'm like in the, what is that, the Matrix in some vat of like, you know, liquid and in some program. I think that you're all actually out there. But there's a way that recognizing that the only thing I can know is this mind's construction, that gives a sense of humility or understanding that, you know, the processes that work to create what's going on in here and seeing that this is a construction of the mind, this thing that I'm seeing, this thing, you know, this seeing thing, this seeing process that's happening is not independent of all the other processes of mind, including beliefs and views and opinions and ideas. And so the seeing is all informed by all these processes, and so there's a lot of room for interpretation. And so understanding that is very freeing. Understanding that this mind is seeing it, that the experiences that we're having are constructed by the mind. And that sense or that recognition, at one point it was felt by me in a kind of the recognition of, oh my gosh, you know, I'm clinging to something, I want something, but the only thing I can possibly cling to is something the mind is making up. That's all there is stuff the mind is creating. And the only thing that we're clinging to is an idea. And when we see that that clinging is so painful and there's nothing actually to cling to, it's just something the mind made up, boy, the mind lets that go. So the seeing things, in the seen is only the seen, and the heard is only the heard, and the sensed is only the sensed, and the cognized is only the cognized, is undermining, is beginning to help the mind to recognize there's no me or I here doing any of this. It's all just processes unfolding. So the next part of the sutta, where the question came from, is when for you. The first is the training. Train in the seen is only the seen, and the heard is only the heard. When for you in the seen is only the seen, and the heard is only the heard, and the sensed is only the sensed, the cognized is only the cognized. There is no you in terms of that. So that was the question. What is this you that this is referred to in the Bahiya Sutta? This you, I understand, is referring to the sense of self. But what is the sense of self? There's not, it feels like something. Feels like, yeah, it feels like I'm here. But when we start to get curious about what is this you? I mean, that's a great question. What is this you? What is this me? What is this I? What am I taking to be I? You don't have to kind of go looking for it, but sometimes there comes up, and this is a great time to be curious about it, there comes up a sense of, yep, I'm here. And that comparing mind is a place that happens. You know, me, you, better, worse. You know, we feel a sense of me there, a sense of I. Or another time that it can come up strongly is, or a sense of it is, when it feels like I'm doing or I'm controlling, I can be in charge, that sense of that. So there's something that feels like me. There's something that feels like an I am. So curiosity about what that is. What is that experience? We can say that, you know, what it actually is, and the teaching of dependent origination points to, it's just another construction in the mind. It's a mental formation. This you is a mental formation that is believed to be an existing being. So that belief gets kind of seen through this process of, and the seen is only the seen, and the heard is only the heard, and the sensed is only the sensed, and the cognized is only the cognized. The belief in that feeling as being something, a stable, lasting thing that's traveling through time. The belief in that gets weaker and weaker and weaker. The more we look at our experience, the more we actually meet our direct experience. We begin to see, and other curiosities, you know, it's like, so when it feels like a sense of me, is that sense always there? And so starting to see that sense of me coming and going. It's just the aggregates. That's all that this thing is. It's just, an interpretation, a misinterpretation of the experience of the aggregates with an imputation of believing that there's a me in there. That's all that that sense of self is. And so this kind of statement, there is no you in terms of that. When in the seen is only the seen and the heard is only the heard, the sensed is only the sensed, the cognized is only the cognized, the mind understands that, oh, this process that I thought was me, it's just this process unfolding. There's no me in that process. It's just another part of the arising experience. That's all it is. And so that phrase, there's no you in terms of that. There's no you in terms of seeing. There's no you in terms of hearing. There's no you in terms of sensing or cognizing. So the mind understanding that process of selfing, that process of identification, it's just another process. When there's no you in terms of that, and this is Thanissaro Bhikkhu's translation. For me, it's evocative, this particular translation. Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation to me is a little more clunky. I don't quite have to think about it. It puts me into a thinking mode, Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. But Thanissaro Bhikkhu's translation is more like, it feels like it's just evoking something that I might be able to taste. When for you in the seen is only the seen, the heard is only the heard, the sensed is only the sensed, the cognized is only the cognized, there's no you in terms of that. When there's no you in terms of that, there is no you there. One sees, it's not a thing, just a process. Maybe that points to what the Buddha described in his own experience. One does not conceive of one who sees, does not conceive of one who hears. No you there. No one who sees, no one who hears, no one who senses, no one who cognizes, just cognizing, just sensing, just seeing, just hearing. When there is no you there, you're neither here nor yonder nor between the two. That part I'm not quite sure I understand. So I just let that one sit. What does that mean? There's no location. It's pointing somehow to location, right? Here, there, in between. There's no locating of being. This is the end of suffering. So just to close this piece out and end, it's I'll just offer what Malyang Kaputa how he translated the Buddha's words, how he understood it. As the Buddha said, after he had a spontaneous poetic expression. And in this case, I do like Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. So I'll read that. So Malyan Kaputa says, "I understand in detail, Venerable Sir, the meaning of what was stated by the Blessed One in brief. Having seen a form with mindfulness muddled, attending to the pleasing sign, one experiences it with infatuated mind and remains tightly holding to it. Many feelings flourish within, originating from visible form, covetousness and annoyance as well, by which one's mind becomes disturbed. For one who accumulates suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be far away." I like that term, mindfulness muddled. Having seen a form with mindfulness muddled. Having heard a sound with mindfulness muddled. Having smelt an odor, and here he actually pulls out the other senses, which the Buddha did not explicitly do. Having heard a sound, having seen a form, having heard a sound, having smelt an odor, having enjoyed a taste, having felt a contact with mindfulness muddled, having known an object, this is the cognizing, with mindfulness muddled. When firmly mindful, one sees a form. One is not inflamed by lust for forms. One experiences it with dispassionate mind and does not remain holding it tightly. One fares mindfully in such a way that even as one sees the forms and while one undergoes a feeling, suffering is exhausted, not built up. For one dismantling suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be close by. So it's interesting to me here that really he's pointing to, in his interpretation, in his understanding of what the Buddha said, he says, well, what I'm hearing you say is, when I'm not mindful, my mind's going to go to the pleasing and push away the displeasing, and the mind's going to get attached and annoyed, and it's going to be painful. But if I see it with mindfulness, the mind is not in that place of being hooked in, wanting and not wanting. One experiences it with a mind of dispassion, the mind that is not hooked, not picking up. That's what I hear you're encouraging me to do, explore my experience in that way. He doesn't pick up on getting hooked into or kind of saying, okay, so tell me, what does it mean, not self here? You know, it's just like, yeah, I hear that craving and clinging, that's what I need to look at. So I think that's a pointing for us too. We can understand. It can be useful at times to be curious about the sense of self. But it really, the processes by which the sense of self arises are the same processes by which suffering arises. And the teaching of dependent origination, that construction of suffering, how the mind goes from feeling to craving to clinging to becoming to birth to the entire mass of suffering, that process which is described, becoming and birth are one way we could look at the sense of self arising, and it's the same description, the same process by which suffering arises. And so looking at suffering, being curious about suffering, will begin to dismantle not only the suffering, but the idea of the sense of self. And that's what this teaching says, you know. Here's the training. Explore the seen is only the seen. The heard is only the heard. And then when that's the case, there will be no you in terms of that. We don't have to try to get rid of the you. We don't even necessarily have to try to understand what the you is. Just be curious about how craving and clinging are muddling mindfulness. So the ending of the story here. Venerable Malyankaputta got up from his seat and bowed down to the Blessed One, circled around him, keeping the Blessed One to his right side and left. Then dwelling alone, secluded, heedful, ardent and resolute, and no long time reached and remained in the supreme goal, they became free from greed, aversion, and delusion. But it's not like, you know, the Bahia Sutta where just hearing it was enough. He actually went off, sat in retreat, and looked at his mind. So that's what we're doing too. So we're just slightly over, so I won't ring the bell. Just keep sitting if you wish. Those of you who have work in the kitchen, there's 27 minutes before dinner. So thank you.